This is a detective story. It's the story of an investigation into the life and cataclysmic death of a star in the sky, a single object 10,000 million million miles distant from the Earth we live on. In this story, the first and most vital clue was found in libraries of Oriental books, in copies of ancient Chinese chronicles. The books tell of what we now believe to have been a vast explosion, the transfiguration and rebirth of a star into a fantastic, almost inconceivable, new state of matter. The record reports the events of a certain day in the year 1054.
The chief of the astronomical bureau reported that from the fifth moon of the first year of the period Chai Ho, a guest star had appeared in daylight in the eastern heavens.
In the Song dynasty, such an omen had to be explained to the emperor.
Yang Weite said, "Prostrating myself, I have observed the appearance of a guest star. On the star, there was slightly an iridescent yellow color. Respectfully, according to the dispositions for emperors, I have prognosticated, and the result said, the guest star does not infringe upon the star Aldebaran. This shows that a plentiful one is Lord, and that the country has a great worth."
The new star shone in the constellation of Taurus. It was said that pointed rays shot out from it on all sides, and that the color was reddish-white. Altogether, it was visible in daylight for 23 days. It seems likely that the event seen by the naked eye of the Chinese astrologers was what's called a supernova, the total disintegration of an aging star. For 900 years later, in that same part of the sky, is the cloud of debris that we now call the Crab Nebula. The history of this object that's now barely visible to the eye, even through our most powerful telescopes, has been said more closely to resemble a tale of mystery and imagination than a sober scientific recital. And yet, in it is reflected the whole story of modern astronomy, the rapid progress in the techniques that are used, and above all, the scientist's delight in the use of his imagination to unravel one mystery after another. Professor Philip Morrison.
The Crab Nebula somehow, by good luck, is close enough to us and is complex enough and new enough event that it acts as a kind of Rosetta Stone to the life and death of stars, I think. Trouble is, unlike the Rosetta Stone, we don't know very well any of the languages in which it's written. It's written in a whole collection of languages. They all say the same thing. We don't have a good knowledge of any one of them. But we try to translate them together, and we are making some progress.
At Lick Observatory on Mount Hamilton, California, are some of the telescopes that have been used to try to establish whether the Crab Nebula is a modern remnant of the Chinese guest star. When Albert Crossley of Halifax, England, gave a 36-inch reflector telescope to Lick back in 1895, the sky outside the solar system was still widely regarded as unchanging in historical time, too vast and distant for man to observe the progress of astronomical events. This telescope stood here many years before that idea was finally abandoned. But if the crab were the result of so recent an explosion, it should be possible to see it, to measure it still growing. Even so, the astronomers who first saw changes in its appearance were reluctant to ascribe them to physical motion. It was in the year 1899 that this telescope was used with a camera to take this time exposure of the crab. On the same telescope today, a new photograph has been taken. The crab has visibly grown within a man's lifetime. Here it is again. 1899 and today. It must be expanding by 800 miles every second. That's growing at a rate of 3 million miles an hour. Today, astronomers work on the assumption that the Chinese guest star and the Crab Nebula are the same object. But the evidence is limited and highly circumstantial, and they'd like a few more details. So, cave drawings by American Indians have been examined, hopefully. Did this represent a bright new star shining near the moon? Many people seem to have accepted that it's probable, though here the evidence is far from strong. And what about European records? This was at a time when the appearance of Halley's comet was very clearly depicted on the Bayeux tapestry. We know, we can both see and read, that they took notice of great events in the skies, but no reference to the star of 1054 has yet been found among European records from the time of Harold until the year 1731.
In the 18th century, quite a few people systematically studied and mapped the sky with small telescopes. This happens to be a print of that section. It's an engraving, colored engraving, a couple hundred years old, of that part of the sky where the Crab Nebula is. You see Orion with the raised hand of the club. And the Bull here, almost crowded out of the picture. There's his horn. And in the tip of the horn of the Bull is a gray disk, quite unlike all the yellow pointed stars that are marked on the diagram, because John Bevis, the English amateur, very high quality amateur, who made this map, was the first to discover and note the existence of this little gray patch in the sky, which is all you see, one of a few hundred like it, in the small telescopes.
But it was William Parsons, the third Earl of Ross, who gave the nebula a name. Working with what was, for the time, a mammoth 72-inch telescope, he saw enough to sketch out a form different from any that we see today and which he called the Crab. But in this catalogue it had already been allocated a number, object number one, later called M1 after Charles Messier, a Frenchman who took special note of the nebula.
Strangely enough, Messier made his map not because he was interested in the Crab Nebula at all, because he was trying to get people to avoid looking at the Crab Nebula. He was a comet hunter. In those days, nobody cared in the least about the fixed stars much, and certainly not about nebulae, which were patches of light they couldn't understand. What they were interested in was motion, planets, new planets, asteroids, and comets. The prediction of the return of Halley's Comet had galvanized science, and when it came back, the public mind was caught. When a comet is near the sun, it has a nice bright tail, and anybody can see it in the telescope. But when it's just a little faint patch, and you can hardly recognize it, you can tell only because when you looked in the sky last week at that same point, it wasn't there. Therefore, you have to know the sky very well. In order to help people out, Messier very generously published a list of the 100 objects in his little telescope that could be mistaken for the early view of comets, and one of them was a Crab Nebula. He said, don't look here, it's not a comet, it won't move.
But that item number one in a list of objects to be ignored was eventually studied in precise detail. Dr. Joe Miller.
The Crab Nebula really looks pretty dull when you see it through a big telescope because you can't see any colors at all. It's just a very faint gray patch. But if you take very long time exposures, as much as, say, 6 hours with a telescope of this size, you can get pictures that show it in all its colors, very beautiful pictures. This color photograph is made up from three separate and white pictures which were taken through different colored filters and shows the Crab Nebula in its true color, that is, the color you would see if you could look through an enormous telescope. The real goal, though, isn't only to get a pretty picture, but is to get indications of which areas deserve closer study with a 120-inch telescope.
Looking in detail at the Crab, we see several things. An inner cloud, a mass of glowing gas, the so-called amorphous region. Most of the stars that we see have nothing to do with the Crab, though one, it was suggested many years ago, could be a remnant of the original explosion, though it didn't seem bright enough to account for the glow in the nebula around it. And a third component is the filaments. They show up as denser strands of material surrounding the central cloud. In this negative of the Crab, again shot as a time exposure on the 120-inch telescope.
There's one very important reason we're studying the filaments in the Crab Nebula. They represent material that was just recently inside of a star, material that was heavily enriched with the heavier elements that is now being returned to the area between the stars, and at some time in the future may make itself into new stars. This process goes on again and again in the universe, with old stars giving their material to provide for the birth of new stars at some time in the future. Ourselves, and the world we see around us, was at some time in the past perhaps involved in one of these enormous supernova explosions.
A dying star finds its last gasp of energy by fusing the hydrogen, then the helium, to form the carbon, oxygen, and finally the iron that we need for our own flesh and blood. The filaments of the Crab that the camera records and that the computer analyzes into the slices that we now seem to journey through are seeding the galaxy with these same atoms of carbon, oxygen, sulfur, and many others that may condense to form new planetary systems, creating once again the conditions for life to be formed far into the future. The sophisticated techniques of the optical astronomers have revealed this faint object as remarkably complex, a puzzle, and a puzzle still with many pieces missing. But it was with the birth, now over 20 years ago, of the new science of radio astronomy that the Crab first shouted its importance from the skies. It was totally unexpected. Though it was so far away, the new telescopes saw it as one of the brightest sources of radio waves in the sky. It was a turning point in astronomy. Professor Graham Smith.
The discovery of radio waves from the Crab Nebula, which is right at the beginning of radio astronomy, led to a tremendous rebirth of interest in astronomy generally, and especially for us here in Britain. It led, of course, to the construction of the radio observatories, like this one we're in now, and it also led to an extraordinary rebirth of interest in other branches of astronomy, and optical and radio astronomy began to be tied together. All this came from that discovery in Australia by John Bolton, using quite simple equipment. Of course, the results he got then were very, very simple. He just showed that there was a source of radio waves, and if you thought of this as a picture of the sky, you'd just see a blur at the position of the Crab Nebula.
This fuzzy blob was about the right size and shape to be the Crab, but to get it into somewhat sharper focus, to obtain a true picture, required interferometers. Several dishes a mile or so apart, working together as one huge telescope, and providing a mass of readings best left to a computer to sort out. To a big computer, it's a small task to reduce all the data to a simple contour map of what was certainly now the Crab Nebula. We now see what appears to be a glowing mass of gas, once again the amorphous region, pouring out radio waves with an intensity 100 times that of all the energy from the sun. But for a cloud of debris that had been cooling for 900 years, this was far too bright. Presumably, it's being kept hot, being acted upon by some unknown influence. And there was more evidence of this to be found in the light from the Crab, when it was photographed through polarized glass that filters the light in a special way. As the glass was rotated, stage by stage, to different angles, the nebula changed in every picture. An ordinary glowing mass of hot gas would not do this. It would be the same however you turned the glass. But then it was discovered that a mechanism which could produce both light and radio waves and could polarize them, could organize the light in just this way, had already been found at some 4 laboratories on Earth. And this, in England, is one of them. Literally buried in the Cheshire countryside is this vast circular machine, within which are conditions very like those in the near vacuum of the expanding plasma of the Crab. This is an electron synchrotron.
The job that this machine has to do is to accelerate electrons to very high energies. To do this, they're made to run in a tube, which goes round a circle more than 200 feet across. And they're kept in that circular track by a strong magnetic field made by currents in these two coils here, which follow all the way around the track. Now, the nuclear physicists who use this machine want the electrons to have as high an energy as they can possibly get. And so they make the electrons go around the track many times, 10,000 times. But the fact that they're going around in a circle and the fact that there's a strong magnetic field actually makes the electrons lose energy almost as fast as we can give it to them. And this radiation is called synchrotron radiation. Now, the radiation comes out in the form of light and radio. And it turns out that in the Crab Nebula, you've got electrons of high energy and a magnetic field, and you can get radiation by just the same process, light and radio, coming out of the nebula and using up a lot of energy from the nebula as they do so.
It was a Russian, Yosef Shklovsky, who first suggested this mechanism for the Crab. But if the Crab were a vast synchrotron, this raised an even bigger question. The electrons whirling through the nebula had to be coming from somewhere. Somewhere in the Crab, there just had to be a powerhouse, something no one had yet recognized, but which was accelerating electrons to nearly the speed of light. So theories about what might happen when a star runs out of fuel were re-examined. When the fires of our own sun are finally exhausted, 5,000 million years from now, it's expected to collapse in on itself, the atoms crushing tightly together under enormous forces of gravity to form a dwarf star, still glowing white hot and about the size of the Earth. Such white dwarf stars are known to exist. But if the very atoms of a star were forced to collapse in on themselves, theory predicted that you could get the same amount of material into a star, a neutron star it was called, just 7 miles across. Professor Mal Rudeman.
If we were, for example, to move onto the surface of a neutron star, our heads would weigh as much as, say, 100 large ocean liners. The strength of the surface is that it could support structures, let's call them mountains, which might be a foot high or so. It would be a very exotic picture because the atmosphere is only a few inches high and they could stick right through the atmosphere. It would be an interesting sport to try to climb it because it would take you about the energy expenditure of your whole lifetime to move up an inch.
It's been calculated that if a star between 4 and 8 times the size of the sun were to collapse, it would create a star of this size but of enormous mass. If such a neutron star were at the center of the Crab, it was suggested, it could be acting in some way as the missing source of power. But even with our largest telescopes, how would you search for such a tiny object just 7 miles across at a distance of 10,000 million million miles? The neutron star was regarded as a mythical beast of no interest to practical astronomers who had better things to do with their time and their telescopes. So, what was to be the crucial discovery at first had nothing to do with either neutron stars or the Crab. At the Mallard Radio Observatory in Cambridge in 1967, the new instrument was perhaps the least glamorous telescope ever built. It looked like 4.5 acres of washing line. It was created for an investigation into certain special galaxies that are far across the universe. For this, it had to be extremely sensitive, so they simply covered a field with radio aerials. In fact, more than 2,000 of them. The array could not be moved to track a star. It simply rotated with the Earth, scanning continuously, night and day, across the sky. And it was to be operated full-time by one person, a girl, the graduate student who'd helped to build it, Jocelyn Bell.
We were actually using this telescope to look for quasars, because they twinkle. And this thing's specially designed to pick out twinkling things. And after we'd been running, I suppose, about a few months, I began to notice there was something slightly curious on the records. They came out as paper charts. And, of course, on these charts you could see radio sources, and, unfortunately, you could also see man-made interference. But there was also something that didn't quite fit either bill. It wasn't exactly a twinkling radio source, and it wasn't exactly interference either. And then we began to notice that it was coming at the same sidereal time each time. In other words, it kept pace with the stars, not with any of our man-made activities which go by the sun or by Greenwich Mean Time.
The analysis of some 3.5 miles of data took patience and persistence, but in the end, she satisfied herself that this was a star that ticks like a clock. It was beating time in periods of just over a second. What was the first reaction of her supervisor, Dr. Tony Hewish?
It's absolute nonsense. You don't believe this at all. It must be something artificial. Nothing in nature could do this, so you disbelieve it as long as you possibly can.
Everybody's first reactions were that it must be man-made. Second reactions, not really voiced very loud, were, well, perhaps it's little green men, another civilization. They could produce a man-made signal. They would be close to a star, like our sun, and they'd move around with the stars. I think perhaps being younger myself, I found it slightly easier to believe than some of the older hands at the game. But we did really spend a lot of time with that first one trying to explain it away. We wrote round to all the astronomical observatories in sort of Britain saying, have you had any program going which might possibly cause radio interference? Because of course the only people who keep sidereal hours, sidereal times, are astronomers. It was easier with the second one. And that was a great relief in many ways, because it removed this possibility of it being little green men. Highly unlikely that several lots of little green men would be all signalling to us, all at the same frequency, all at the same time.
Later, Jocelyn Bell wrote up her work for the degree of Doctor of Philosophy. Mostly, her thesis is about how the aerial system works. Almost in passing, it records one of astronomy's most exciting discoveries. This was an entirely new type of star. The hunt was now on, and everybody joined in a sort of galactic gold rush. The discoveries poured into the scientific papers. A name was invented, pulsars, and this pulsarium was constructed to show their location and characteristics. To see them clearly in this demonstration, they're made to flash at a tenth of their real speed. Most of them pulse at intervals of between 1 and 3 seconds. Also, the majority of them seem to lie in the plane of, and therefore must be part of, our own galaxy. But what are they?
When the pulsars were first discovered, everyone tried to explain the rapid pulsations in terms of something they knew about, a white dwarf star. A very much condensed star, which has got the same mass as the Sun, but it's much more like the size of the Earth. And if it could be made to vibrate, it would vibrate very fast. Now, the vibrations would be expected to take a few seconds, but when pulsars were discovered with about 1 second period, it seemed possible to make this work. Then, of course, there was one discovered in the Vela Nebula, and this was vibrating 10 times a second, and things got very difficult. It wasn't really, though, until the Crab Nebula came into the picture that the final blow was dealt to this theory.
Several of the earlier pulsars had already been discovered here at Greenbank in the Allegheny Mountains of West Virginia. The 300-foot dish at the American National Radio Astronomy Observatory is bigger than the famous Mark I at Jodrell Bank, but a little less maneuverable. It was one of the many that was hopefully turned towards the Crab. With the telescope now centered on a point within the nebula, a computer will make the constant fine adjustments to compensate for the rotation of the Earth.
Okay, are we on source?
Yeah, we're on source.
Good. Is the frequency set?
Right.
Start the scan then. Yep.
But the Crab doesn't respond to a technique that works well for other pulsars. No pulse, no blip can be seen on this trace. Nor do we hear the characteristic tick, tick, tick of a pulsar. But the crucial discovery was made using this 300-foot dish. It was coupled to a computer which was supposed to separate any pulses from the radio noise and then work out the period, the frequency at which they tick. But in addition, the telescope was set up to receive and analyze a whole range of radio wavelengths to measure another property of the pulses called dispersion. Dr. Dave Stalin.
Let me explain what dispersion is. If you were to hear with your ears what a pulsar emits in the way of signals, you would hear a click if you were to stand immediately next to the pulsar. If, however, you were to stand thousands of light years away, that click, as it moves through the interstellar medium, moves in such a way that the low frequencies travel more slowly. And as a result, instead of hearing a periodic click, you would hear a whistle. The rate at which it whistles is a direct measure, then, of the distance away from the pulsar. After taking data for about 3 weeks, we then buried ourselves in the computer room looking for these objects. We spent a great deal of time trying to unravel the nature of what was actually a very peculiar response. It was not what we expected at all, but rather, instead of a periodic signal, we had responses at many periods, but one value of dispersion. So we were excited, but we knew we had to dig deeper into it to make sure it was not a computer problem or some source of interference. So we spent then a weekend on our stomachs over a large amount of detailed printout, giving every number we had received and attempting to find some pattern emerge from this plethora of numbers. So we circled the large numbers, and out of this pattern of randomness, seeming randomness, indeed the pattern we were searching for emerged, a descending whistle. We knew we had a pulsar.
But what they had not discovered was the period. But the next stage of the story followed quickly, and it took place in Puerto Rico at Arecibo, where a fantastic landscape has allowed a natural bowl to be formed into the dish of the biggest radio telescope in the world. Here, too, they'd been searching for pulsars. 3 weeks before Stalin and Riefenstein's experiment, they'd looked at the crab, had found no clear signal, and had moved on. The huge Arecibo dish was now concentrating the radio noise from more promising parts of the sky. But when Stalin and Riefenstein's paper appeared, they at once swung their antenna back to focus on the crab. They now knew exactly what had to be done to separate the pulses from the loud background hiss of the nebula. At Arecibo, the young team included graduate student Dave Richards.
I didn't realize it at the time that momentous events like this don't occur every day. The pulsar game developed very rapidly that first year, and discoveries haven't been pouring in at the same rate. So we were certainly very lucky to be there at that time.
Not everybody has such a good subject for their thesis.
By no means.
In fact, two very important results had been discovered. First, the period of the crab pulsar was very much faster than any previously known. It was flashing at a rate of 30 pulses every second. And even more startling, the period was changing. It was actually slowing down. It must be losing energy. When they double-checked their figures on this slowdown, the observers reported by radio link to Arecibo's parent institution at Cornell University in upstate New York.
Yes, we are calling to find out
the most significant figures that you have. Over.
648.
Until this day, the question of the real nature of pulsars had still not been completely settled. At Cornell, Professor Tommy Gold had been saying all along that the answer must be a neutron star. But few people agreed with him, and he hadn't been able to prove his case until he heard that the crab pulsar was slowing down.
Oh, that's marvelous. That's just what we wanted.
Of course, the moment we knew the slowdown for the pulsar, we could work out the amount of energy being lost. And it was a quite simple calculation. One knew the mass and size of neutron stars pretty well. And so I did this calculation in a hurry, and it came out to the figure 2 × 10⁻³⁸ ergs per second. But the moment I wrote that down, I couldn't remember what the luminosity of the crab was, what the total energy requirement for this mysterious energy source was. And so, in great excitement, I sent Mr. Williams over to the library to fetch the reference, which was an article by Shklovsky some few years ago.
Here we are, 1966.
So here we have Shklovsky's estimate. He says relativistic electrons are injected at a rate of about 10⁻³⁸ ergs per second. Incredibly close to the figure we had. We had written down 2 × 10⁻³⁸ ergs per second. So clearly here we had the answer. This was the mysterious energy source of the crab. But not only that, after all, we had to take into consideration that it was a neutron star to get this figure, the mass and size. And so we had proved all at once, it seemed, that the object in the crab, the pulsar, was indeed a rotating neutron star, derived its energy from its spin, and was flashing to us like a lighthouse beacon. It was not any more possible to think that it was a white dwarf or some other astronomical object. It was quite clear that indeed it had to be that fantastic object, a neutron star.
And the neutron star would have a magnetic field, like those of the Earth or Sun, but something like a million, million times stronger. At Princeton, Professor Jerry Ostreicher.
If the star was rotating, even slightly to begin with, when it collapses to a neutron star state from the conservation of angular momentum, it'll spin up faster and faster. So you have a rotating bar magnet. One could imagine this to be the bar of the magnet in this direction, and the fields coming out, let's call this the North Pole, and this the South Pole, and that little white square in the center being the neutron star. Then if in addition it was rotating very rapidly around like this, the lines get swept back into a kind of spiral pattern. I had a little model made up of it, and here you can see the red is to represent the neutron star, and you can see the lines being swept back. And if I move it, you can see the appearance of waves going out. Now any particle emitted by the neutron star would get caught on the wave and kind of ride it out like a surfer on a wave out into the nebula and get to very high energies. The electrons would be just about right to produce the glow we see in the nebula. If I plug it in, it should go at about the velocity of the Crab, which is a period of 300ths of a second. At that velocity, it just looks like a blur. You can't see a thing. And I think that's why no one had seen the pulsar pulsing. It was smoothed out and looked like an ordinary star.
The brightness of the nebula now seemed to be accounted for, but the pulses were still a mystery. The optical astronomers had already begun their search for pulses, stars flashing with visible light, in the hope that the extra information might provide some clue about how the pulses are produced. Because they had never been seen, it was expected that any optical pulsars would be faint. So Dr. Roderick Wilstrop in Cambridge used neither his eye nor a photographic plate, which would certainly smooth out any pulsation. Instead, he placed a photomultiplier at the focus of the telescope. This amplifies the light that's falling on it at any moment in time so that fluctuations up and down can be recorded. In an ideal case, you might get a record that looks like this. By simply flashing a light 25 times a second, a series of clear pulses has been produced along the top edge. But a real pulsar would be faint and there'd be a lot of other light around, so in practice, you'd expect to get a general mush like this, which would have to be fed into a computer to search for any fluctuations that might be present. Wilstrop remembers vividly one particular night. At Arecibo, they were still convincing themselves of the spin down of the Crab. Gold, almost at this very moment, was proving that pulsars were neutron stars. But Wilstrop, who'd already been patiently searching for optical pulsars for some time, did not have this vital extra clue. So, like everybody else, he was still much more interested in white dwarfs. All the same, some pulses had recently been reported from the region of the Crab, and it was certainly worth taking readings from that general direction.
Well, this is the notebook I was using on the 23rd of November, 1968. And looking over the notes that I made at that time, the first thing that strikes me is the number of times the sky clouded up and cleared again during the night. I went to bed at 9:30, because it was then cloudy, and by 10:30 it had cleared, so I got up again and came out to observe. I decided it was time to start work on the Crab Nebula, and I found it without any difficulty. I made a note that I could see faint star-like condensations in it, and if I could find a photograph of it, I might identify the central object. So I went to the library at 11:55, and when I came out at 12:10, it was cloudy. And soon after 2:30, it started clearing from the west again, and at about 2:56, I began the vital run on the Crab Nebula, which lasted for about 11.5 minutes.
But Wilstrop's observational technique was better than the program that had been worked out for his computer. So the results weren't analyzed at once. Instead, they just piled up on paper tape. But in the scientific world, the rewards, the names quoted in the history of a subject, the recognition, go to those who complete the work and publish it first. And here in Arizona were two Americans, Don Taylor and John Koch, working as a team of three with an Englishman, Mike Disney, who's now moved to Australia.
He's doing some theoretical work on the pulsar.
None of them had much of a background in practical astronomy, but as soon as the period of the Crab pulsar was published, they decided to look at just that one object. In fact, they used not one of the big telescopes for which Kitt Peak is world famous, but the relatively small instrument of a neighboring observatory. Dr. John Koch recalls the last night of their observations.
Cold. Cold and clear. A bit windy. It was hard to set on the pulsar because the telescope was bouncing around quite a bit because of the wind.
They knew the exact period they were looking for. It was to be displayed visually. No computer was needed. And then a tape machine was to be used to record the signals from the photomultiplier.
This next observation will be observation number 18.
To make a clear recording of the signals, the microphone had to be taken out of circuit. But in fact, for the crucial observation, it seemed that it was pulled out only part of the way. So by accident, it also recorded the voices of the observers.
You've got a bleeding pulse here.
It can be.
Look!
God!
It's a bloody good pulse.
It is, isn't it?
God, just come look at it down here.
This is a historic moment.
Christ almighty, look at that.
Daddy, what?
God, I really can't believe it, you know?
They'd never tried before, and never again since, but in just 5 nights they found the pulsar and recorded it, on paper, if not in sound. The original record of that first observation shows a flash of light from the crab, a flash 30 times every second.
I heard about this discovery about 8 weeks after my own observations had been made, and of course my first reaction was great disappointment. Of course, in these circumstances, the most important thing to do is to pick up the pieces and use the observations to try to confirm the discovery. If you're going to be first with results in scientific research, you have to have the luck to make the right decisions and to analyze the right data. And in this case, I didn't.
All ready, Carl. Start the tape.
This is a taped record of light from the crab pulsar.
There it goes. You can see the peak already building up right there.
The trace scans once across the tube in each revolution of the star. Every 30th of a second, the picture becomes clearer. It shows that on each revolution of the pulsar, there's a main pulse, and then a smaller but longer pulse half a revolution later. Professor Paul Horowitz.
This is about, after about 10 minutes worth of data, several interesting things here. You can see that the main peak here doesn't have any flat top. And this alone, this measurement alone, sets an upper limit on the size of the radiating region of the pulsar of about 30 kilometers or 20 miles. The object that's radiating simply can't be larger.
This is a direct observation confirming the calculations of the theorists and shows that the light and radio pulses must be coming from a very confined space in or near the star. Dr. Tony Hewish.
Now, I favour the theory that the radiation is emitted close to the surface of the star in the region of the magnetic pole, because here there can be a very rapid escape of charged particles, electrons and protons, along the magnetic field, and they can radiate an intense beam of radio and light along this magnetic axis, so that as the neutron star spins, then we see a flash each time the beam is pointing towards us. The pulses are very sharp, and they're lined up to better than 1/10,000th of a second. I think one can only explain this easily if the radiation comes from close to the surface.
The next stage was to see which of the stars in the crab was flashing in this way, too fast for the eye to see. Using the big telescope here at Lick, an ingenious way around this problem was found. The light was reflected to a focus below ground where Dr. Joe Wampler rigged up the makeshift equipment that was finally to identify the central star.
In order to locate the position of the pulsar itself, we used a rotating shutter just in front of the focal plane of the telescope. The focal plane of the telescope is just about here, and took a series of television photographs of the central region of the Crab Nebula. The shutter rotated in such a way that its frequency was slightly different from the frequency of the pulsar itself. This allowed us to essentially slow down the frequency of the pulsation. It's a stroboscopic effect, very similar to the effect that you see on Western movies between the shutter speed of the movie camera and the spokes of a wagon wheel.
Through the shutter, they looked with their television camera, and straight away they saw it, the star to the right of center, off, on, off, on, off, on.
Of course, when the pulsar immediately came into the field of view, we were very delighted indeed. And I guess Joe says that we jumped up and down a little bit. I don't remember jumping up and down, but I won't say that I didn't.
We can now see the powerhouse in the crab. We can see a neutron star. But here at Princeton, a new puzzle had emerged. It was discovered by a student, Ed Groth, who was timing the accuracy of the pulsar clock. In summer 69, both Princeton and Arecibo were timing the Crab, though here Arecibo broke down, leaving Princeton on their own. It was just after this that the pulsar went haywire. It had been almost steady up until this final night's readings. Then, suddenly, in late September, a jump. The clock is running faster, spinning just a little bit faster. For 2 years after that glitch, as it was called, there's been skepticism as to whether it really happened, because, curiously, Princeton's data wasn't published. So it was left to these two students with a 24-inch telescope at Lick to confirm that there are smaller jumps in the Crab-Pulsar period, taking place all the time. But what causes a glitch?
Well, the problem is, of course, that a great deal could be happening, and so one can write lots of scenarios, and they all survive for a long time. Now, the Crab has a solid crust, and the crust has solidified rather early in the lifetime of this pulsar, quite soon after it was formed, 1,000 years or so ago. Now, when it was formed, it didn't have quite the shape it does now because it was rotating more rapidly, and the rotation affects its shape. And since we know it's slowing down, we know its shape is changing, and this will put the crust under a strain. What isn't known is how the crust that's put under a strain manages to relax and get rid of the strain. It could flow plastically, meaning it could very gradually accommodate to the strain, something like a molasses or a very viscous liquid, or it might crumble like a cookie, or it might snap now and then, like earthquakes on Earth. And if it's the latter, then one would expect to see a change in the timing of the Crab, which is similar to what has been seen.
Whether or not a star quake is the cause of all the commotion, there's violent activity in the nebula. In particular, the fuzzy wisps of material near the pulsar are said to have moved violently away from the neutron star after the 1969 glitch, afterwards returning to their original position as part of a continuing ballet of motion in the amorphous region of the nebula. Light from the Crab has been studied in precise detail for 70 years and radio for over 20, for one simple reason. Light and radio reach the ground. But the astronomers know that these two very limited ranges are telling only a small part of the story of the Crab and its pulsar. So a tremendous amount of current work is now going into studies of infrared, ultraviolet, X-rays, and gamma rays from the Crab. And little or none of those can reach us here on the ground. With rockets to carry their detectors high above the atmosphere for just a few brief minutes, X-ray physicists had already opened a new window onto the universe in the early 60s. Once again, astronomy was to be galvanized by observations of the Crab. The instruments themselves are still primitive compared with the simplest optical or radio telescopes. Here, a bank of detectors is shielded on all sides except one, where a honeycomb allows in the X-rays from just one part of the sky. Through the unfocused eye of the rocket detector, no detail could be seen. But the power in those X-rays was fantastic, far more than in the Crab's light and radio combined. But for some people, rockets are only a starting point.
A lot of track.
With its enormous investment in space technology already made, America's National Aeronautical and Space Administration now offers astronomers facilities for experiments aboard its orbiting astronomical observatories. So far, however, the program has met with limited success. Of three satellites sent up, one failed to get into orbit and another couldn't be operated when it got there. Dr. Jim Kuperian.
Well, our record is 1 out of 3 at the moment, but this satellite has lasted 3 times longer than we had hoped for. We consider this quite good.
These observations confirm that the Crab is also radiating strongly in the ultraviolet, but there have been no surprises here. No results to rival the excitement of the early X-ray rocket discoveries. But for the sheer expense of satellites, one justification should come quite soon from this, a true X-ray telescope that produces a picture of the object it's looking at. From these polished metal walls, X-rays will be reflected and focused, hopefully to see yet another face of the Crab. But for most purposes and most wavelengths, the radiations from space penetrate deep enough into the atmosphere for them to be reached by payloads which can be launched by a very much cheaper method. Scientists from American research centers, and many from Europe too, bring their experimental packages here to the corner of a small airfield in Palestine, Texas. Operated by the American National Center for Atmospheric Research, this will be a balloon launch. At sunrise, there's generally a lull in the wind for about an hour. To handle the flimsy envelope, the crew need the air to be still, so the launch is scheduled for dawn. This balloon has a capacity of 10 million cubic feet. But only a tiny fraction was filled with helium to allow room for it to expand 100-fold as the payload is carried to the upper atmosphere. The results have been impressive. Balloon flights have shown that the neutron star in the Crab pulses not only with light and radio, but even more strongly with X-rays and gamma rays. A typical payload is this spark chamber. At a height of over 30 miles, it doesn't record the Crab's gamma rays directly. Instead, it sees particles of matter. Every time a particle passes through it and then through a detector below, a high voltage is applied across the many plates of the chamber, and a series of sparks makes the path visible. The majority of these tracks show cosmic rays, the rain of high-energy nuclear particles that pervade space and whose source has puzzled a whole generation of physicists. But it's just a very few rare events that are being sought on these photographs. The cases where the pure energy of a gamma ray strikes a plate and within the chamber breaks up into an electron and a positron whose diverging tracks form an arrow pointing back towards the Crab. And so the number of these, the flow of energy, can be measured in time. So far, the Crab has never disappointed its observers. Whatever the experiment, the Crab and its pulsar are always there, always the first to be seen, and always amongst the brightest objects in the sky. But at the high energies measured in this experiment, the rain of gamma rays from the Crab is thinning a little, so it may soon be possible to sum the total power of this fantastic generating machine. To set an upper limit, we must look for gamma rays 100 or 1,000 times more energetic still. And once again, in the deserts and mountains of Arizona, but this time by a telescope with a difference. It will see the enormously energetic photons at third hand. It's an odd and mysterious process in which the energy is transferred to electrons which drill down towards the telescope, actually coming faster than light itself can travel through the atmosphere. As it does so, each electron radiates a sort of shock wave, a bow wave, a spark of visible light in the sky above. The dozens of hexagonal reflectors add up to a collecting power vastly greater than the biggest telescopes of Palomar and Lick, concentrating and directing the faint blue sparkle into a photomultiplier at the focus of the telescope. After the Russian who first discovered the principle, this is called a Cherenkov detector. And as sun sets to a clear, moonless night, it turns to focus on the Crab. And here at last we find nothing. At these enormous energies, it seems the Crab is almost quiet. An upper limit has been set. But adding together the whole output of the nebula, we've found a total of 25,000 times the power of the sun, still pouring out from the supernova remnant. And if it's like that now, who can imagine what it was like on that day over 900 years ago when it was first seen by the Chinese? The pilot of this aircraft is one who can imagine, and mathematically describe what may happen in the crucial first second of a supernova explosion. But now he has to test his theories by direct observation. This is Dr. Sterling Colgate, whose interests have ranged over atomic bombs, the mechanisms of thunderstorms, and now the death and rebirth of stars. And here on a mountain in New Mexico is the site for his new telescope, a supernova hunter that each night will automatically scan 8,000 galaxies.
We locate the telescope on top of the mountain so that we have clear skies, no dust, no turbulence, to observe the supernova in galaxies that are as distant as a tenth of the distance across the universe.
Colgate has no interest in waiting for the next supernova in our own galaxy. We might see one in 50 years, if we're lucky. Nor does he like the usual idea of taking photographs of the sky every week or so to watch for pinpoints of light, distant galaxies that may have brightened up.
The searches for supernova this way now turn up maybe one a month, maybe a little bit more, maybe a little bit less. It's tedious, and we see supernova rather late in time. It would be exciting, very exciting, for those of us who really want to know why, if we couldn't see the darn things, you know, when they're a few hours old. As early as a few hours, the outer layers of a supernova should be blowing off with the velocity of light.
The telescope will have a television camera linked to a computer memory. But inside this second-hand radar dome, and raised above tree level on a surplus liquid oxygen tank from an Atlas missile, the telescope will economize on everything except performance.
If you're going to look at 8,000 galaxies a night, just pinpoints in the sky, you need a telescope that moves not only very rapidly, but also very accurately. Within about 1 second of time, like this, it can settle within a fraction of a second on a new object, within a very small error. The error is something like a few arc seconds. This is very much more accurate than the usual telescope. It is also very much more rapid in its slewing. When we find a supernova, that is when the computer believes that it has recognized a bright spot in the galaxy, clearly we're not going to ring gongs all over. The computer first has to slew the telescope back to where it thought it saw that supernova. Take another picture, compare it to the picture it took of the same galaxy the night before, already perhaps that night.
The computer must rapidly confirm that there is a new bright spot in the galaxy. Then the measurements will start, to find out what elements are being thrown out, to see how fast the material is coming towards us, to discover the total energy of the explosion.
There are two theories of the origin of supernova that we would very much like to understand. One of these depends upon the dynamical formation of a neutron star. The other depends upon the thermonuclear detonation of the nuclear fuel of the outer layers of the star. We do not know which of these takes place in a supernova, but it makes a very big difference to the theories of the origin of the elements of us, us being the planet Earth. In the dynamical formation of the neutron star, we might make far more heavy elements, that is, like uranium, than we would otherwise suppose. In the thermonuclear detonation, we might not make any. Perhaps both mechanisms are involved in the universe. Perhaps both mechanisms are involved in the makeup of us. By measuring many supernova with a fast telescope like this, by measuring many automatically using a computer to do the spectra and all the other measurements that need to be made, by measuring many galaxies and seeing where the supernova occur, perhaps we can unravel this mystery and find out what really is the origin of us.
For the astronomer riding up to spend the night high in the prime focus of his telescope, as for hundreds of others at the radio dishes or planning their experiments with rockets, satellites, or balloons, that one special supernova, the Crab, has been a source of unending fascination. But what use is the understanding that is gained? Some astronomers and physicists see none at all, that its results are pure knowledge, totally remote and therefore totally harmless. Others more soberly observe that applications have always been found for such knowledge, and that in the neutron star and plasma of the Crab, we're studying forces that we may yet learn to use. But for most of them, such hopes and fears are distant from their thoughts. The scientist's true motivation, the real reason for his work, is more likely to be this.
The sheer joy of a puzzle, prospect of a problem for the mind to work on. Of an endless series of problems, because you solve one and another problem appears. And the mind can always turn itself inward and think of the problem when all other frustrations are gone. I live for problems. I live for solving them. I enjoy the puzzle, the one after the next. I love finding the answer, because the answer always leads to another and another.